You're listening to the Pratfalls Podcast. I'm your host, Levi Weinhagen. You can find me on Twitter, at ThatLevi. Hey, thanks for listening. This show features conversations with creative folks about their creative work and the rest of their lives. We're part of the Noise Picnic Podcast Network. You can go to noisepicnic.com to find other great Twin Cities-based podcasts. This episode is my conversation with Jared Sherlock. Jared is a magician, a writer, a producer, all-around great dude. I really enjoyed talking to Jared. I'm not going to explain a bunch of what we talked about because you're about to listen to us talk about it. So what would be the point of that? I will say, though, you should definitely go to his website. You can watch some videos of some of the work he does. You can check out his schedule. I think you'd really enjoy going to see his show, going to see Jared perform live if you get the chance. I encourage you to do that. All right, enough of that nonsense. Let's get right into it. Here is my conversation with Jared. Well, the first thing I would say is you're Jared Sherlock. That's how I start every
episode. I hope so. Yes. Yeah. We've made a terrible mistake.
I wonder if you can say, like, what you do.
Okay.
Because yeah. I have a view of your work, but even just looking a little deeper, I can see there's way more than just the top line item of your website.
Sure.
It's like you have a main sort of thing, but there's a lot of other things. So what do you say you do?
Are we rolling?
We are rolling.
Yeah. I would say it's happening right now.
Buckle up.
I am a magician and producer, and occasionally when I feel courageous enough, a writer. But as a magician, I perform primarily as a magician, comedian, solo act for private events, primarily throughout the Midwest, but really wherever people will bring me. Yeah. Anywhere that they will allow
magician
me
for hire.
Yeah, you can boil it down. It's like the kindergarten, you know, test. Like when you have a business idea, if you can communicate it, you have to be able to communicate it to a room of kindergartners and make it make sense. And at the end of it, it's like, yeah, magician for hire.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what I do. But in the grand, like you were saying, in the grand scheme of things, it's, I love creating. I love performing is at the core of it, but it's, you know, magic is just a medium for me to better entertain an audience from my vantage point, you know? So it's more about just entertaining.
Yeah. And so just even being a solo performer of sort of the magical arts, illusionist.
Yes. Sometimes. Hogwarts. Yes.
There's a lot of writing there too. So, you know, I know when you say like, and when I feel, sometimes I'll think of myself as a writer, and I know you've written like longer, more fully produced shows, but even in your sort of go do a corporate event, whether that writing happens on your feet or you sitting down and writing, that's writing too, right?
I mean, exactly. Yeah. There's both naturally because it's a one-man show and it's comedy driven and magic is highly interactive. Generally you're working, in many instances, there's a lot of magic that is more than not centered around a subject from the audience being incorporated to it. You know, it's telling a story to the audience, and then you, a lot of times you bring a subject up onto stage to do the trick for them so that you have somebody that's experiencing the magic up close and personal, you know, while the audience is viewing it.
So the show but is like also the person on stage reacting to it.
Exactly. So there is a lot of that writing that you're talking about that's kind of the improvisation part that's in your head where you just kind of like you're on a drug and you just get up there and you say whatever's coming to mind. Any performer, comedic performer, improviser kind of knows what that feels like. And sometimes you miss and sometimes you hit it. And when you hit it, then I'll take, when I find something that works and I say this right line, I always write it down. And then, so that's kind of like the ad lib writing that happens. And then I'll try it again. If it keeps working, then all of a sudden it's written into the actual script of the show. So the show is constantly evolving, but it does start like any show, any non-improvised show, with a structure and with a written script with, you know, good evening, my name's Jared Sherlock. You know, it starts that way, you know, most evening when I walk on stage. And then there's an actual script that's memorized that's been written mostly by me. But in many instances, I'll work with other collaborators. Sometimes I'll bring in people like our mutual friend, Joseph Scrimshaw. We worked on some stuff together. He was kind enough to want to collaborate on one thing. And I'll work with different people that have different perspectives on the type of work that I'm trying to create. And then I will create, you know, I'll write a first draft with the actual trick that we're trying to accomplish, and then work with people that can pepper in smarter, more intelligent, funny things than I can come up with.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you've spent thousands of hours working on how to move your hands properly. So
yeah, some days more than others. But definitely, you know, as a kid, when I started, I was in Society of Young Magicians, and I'd go every other Tuesday to this young magicians group where kids from all around this region, their parents would come and drop them off, and you'd learn a trick, and then your job for the next 2 weeks on this principle was to develop your own version using this technique. And so yeah, I'd be sitting in cars, airplanes, wherever I was, with a deck of cards or coins or some string in my hand, just moving my fingers. It's become increasingly more difficult to make time for that recently with travel and then focusing on the material that's working in the show. But yeah, a lot of time sitting in a room playing with myself. No, that's not. Should have thought about that before I came out.
No, that's your goal. Yeah. That's a new slogan for sure.
I can't say those things on this podcast, can I?
No, you can. Okay. It's right. Fine. It's a grown-up show.
It's that type of show?
Yeah.
All right.
You don't have to. You don't have to be body.
We're changing it. It's going to get get dark in
here, man. I appreciate the ratings.
Yeah.
I'm curious about two things. I do want to talk about sort of the sort of path of getting to where you are now, and you know the story of little Jared. But I'm curious about just a process thing. If you're doing a magic performance, is it like putting together a set list for a band where you're like,
totally,
here's the 12 tricks, and you know there's some idea about how you'll get to each of those things, and maybe something changes on the fly. If you're like, oh, this audience is reacting in a weird way, I'm going to not do the banana gag and instead put it in.
You're absolutely right. And how did you know I have a banana gag?
I've seen a lot of magic.
I knew you were way up in my business. Yes, no, you're exactly right. And a lot of people, of course, this is a podcast for artists and creators, so most people in that field get it. But
no,
it's very much
that
way. It's kind of like it's very much like a band. In fact, I equate a magic trick to a song in a lot of ways. You know, there's a start, there's the story that you tell in that, and then it's an end. And it's anywhere from it could be 30 seconds or a second if it's just one little, you know, mm-hmm, banana gag.
Or that's more than a second.
Yeah, that's maybe more like 45 minutes in my show, but
that's
I don't know about other performers. Generally, my tricks range from anywhere from 2 to 7 minutes. And then once that's done, it's kind of like in its own piece. It's versatile as to where I put it in the show, mm-hmm, and which audience it's appropriate for. So the set list changes nightly based on which crowd I'm in front of, like depending on the demographic or their requests or even just what I'm feeling and what I think's going to work.
Yeah, so you're not bored by something or, you know, you have a new idea.
And that's easy to do, to get complacent. And sometimes it takes like moving a piece out of the show and it just gives new life to it. And sometimes you find that it doesn't work at all. And it's like, oh man, they don't like me unless I finish with that, you know, bullet trick catch. It breathes new life into the show where you discover something that you weren't able to see because you were so comfortable in that rhythm. But yeah, it's normally like, you know, 10 to 12 things in a show, and that set list can be organized. You know, it's basically like my friend and I, Trig Watson, were talking about this the other day on the phone. There's a great element to it, like a band, where you are orchestrating a rhythm for the show, just like any play,
mm-hmm,
you know, to try and get that best reaction. Like you're kind of orchestrating the audience, you know, you're getting them, you're thrilling them and then bringing them back down.
You can't do too much too soon either.
Exactly.
How do I follow myself?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You got to open with something strong and flashy that's quick that gets their attention generally, I think.
And then they trust you, like, oh, you know what you're doing. So now even if you make a mistake.
Exactly. That's my favorite thing is in John Lithgow's drama book. Have you read
his book? No, but
it's an amazing autobiography and that he writes, and it was really moving. I was crying in the prologue, you know, like he was...
That's effective.
It was. I was already just like, oh, this book is so good. He says, you know, an actor, whether you're an actor or you're a director, but, you know, when you're on stage, in those first few moments, you make an agreement, a pact with the audience. And if you do so sincerely, authentically, and enthusiastically, you know, in the spirit of whatever work you're creating, you know, you make that agreement with them and they'll follow you anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They'll follow you. And so that's exactly with the opening. You want to pick something that... For me, I'm in a lot of places where, like, I'm at a corporate event, and they go, "Oh, great! There's a magician on the annual banquet. We can maybe skip out early, you know." And so my job is I have to get up there right away and zing them with a few jokes and do a trick that they kind of go, you know, all right, Magic Boy, we'll give you a chance for a few more minutes.
Yeah. I love that, too. I love that there's something fun in... Because there is, people have a weird relationship with magic where children love it because children aren't cynical yet and they don't know that you're not supposed to like something unironically. Kids haven't learned that yet. But then I feel like grown-ups, like if you're like me and you're like, I just love magic, it's not ironic, I like it, I'm really interested in the process, I'm fascinated by how hard someone will work to make something that everyone knows is you did exactly how you did it and yet it's still impressive. That's just hard work. I love that. But I feel like other people... Like, that's kid stuff. I shouldn't be entertained by this. I don't want to, you know, like, they don't want to be transcended in that way. And it's a weird... And then the idea of you having to overcome that, there's got to be some joy there, too, where you're like, you can spot the dude in the room who's not... He's like, I'm not going to like this. I'm going to make fun of this dude from back here in the conference
center. There's, like, five of those dudes in every show. There's more than that. Men and women, you know, there's people that just decide, like you said, that they... That whether it's uncool or whether they just... Or whether they're just, you know, there's some people that just don't like entertainment in certain ways. Like, their entertainment is sports, or they like, they receive joy in other ways from other experiences, whether it's riding a motorcycle or something. And so there are people in every crowd that are just not digging the entertainment thing, you know, that don't want to make that deal. They don't want to make that pact. They don't even want to try. They, you know, because there is that element where an audience, a show's only as good sometimes as the audience is allowing it to be. You know, like, that's why I love doing ticketed shows sometimes more than private shows, which are the majority of what I do, because when an audience member buys a ticket, they're like, all right, I'm going to give this a chance. I want this to be good. Otherwise, why did we spend, you know, $1 million on Hamilton? You know, like, it's like, I'm going to go in with the best expectations. Yeah. And then you're off and rolling really quickly. But at a corporate event, they're a captive audience that you have to kind of, you have to walk that line of negotiating with them.
Yeah, maybe one person picked to have you there.
Yeah, one person, like an HR person or a committee, or the president saw me at another event and was like, yeah, we gotta have that magic guy. And everybody else was like, what? But yeah, when what you were talking about with the way people view it, whether it's like ironically or not, you're so spot on. And there is an element of certain, I think that there are certain types of art as creators where you do have a little bit of an uphill climb in what the public perception is, or the wide perception of what your skill is. You know, I think that, like, for instance, clowns is a great example.
Mime, juggling, magic, those sort of kind of clowny
juggling
substances.
Yeah, there's like almost a hierarchy, like where you kind of go like, I'd say juggler's maybe a little below magician, but who's to say, you know, it depends.
But mime's on the bottom.
Totally on the bottom. But then when you see it practiced in with care and with great diligence, you know, and with by the best, you know, Marcel Masseau, you know, something like I just butchered that. Or Bill Irwin, you know, as a clown. It's like, then all of a sudden you change somebody's perception. You're like, that's a clown? No, he's Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. It's the same background, you know, discipline. Yeah. It's like, that's pure art, pure brilliance, you know? And so I think people with magic have seen the birthday party magician, which some are really good.
Yeah.
Like, I think more often than not, people see when it's magic for kids, bad magic. But there are, like, there are so many amazing... It's the hardest type, I think. There's some experts that go directly to entertaining for children and kids, and that is the hardest type of magic, because kids are smarter than
And they don't care
adults.
About your feelings.
They don't care about feelings, and they're watching you like a hawk. They see things adults don't see, because you can manipulate an adult's attention and change their perception and misdirect them pretty easily. There's a lot of psychology in how
you can use social pressures on adults in a different way.
Exactly. But kids, they're just like, you know... They're watching. They're game for anything, but they're paying really close attention. And they, like you said, they're open-minded. To them, they don't know how the world works. They don't know enough about how the world works to notice when it's working incorrectly. So you have to tell a different story to them. But for an adult, you might have seen David Copperfield or Penn and Teller or somebody of that stature, and then there's that range between them.
Right.
You know, the birthday party entertainment up to one of the richest men in or comedy duos in Las Vegas world history, built Forbes billion. You know, and so you have to... So then there's a huge... Then everybody else is in between. And a vast majority of magicians are hobbyists, I'd say. And then there are, you know, professionals. And then within the professionals, there are stage performers and a lot of magicians that work privately that you've never heard of that make very good careers and are expert entertainers and speakers. that you've just that will go their whole career and you'll never know who they are, but they're very good. And then there are the ones that are pursuing more public ticketed theater events, and yeah, those generally go down the comedic route, working fairs, festivals, comedy clubs, and then they find their way to cruise ships or big public venues where America's Got Talent that boots them up into the limelight,
you know? Yeah.
And and so depending on what you've seen, I guess a long way of saying, like, an audience can come into it very skeptical, and you know, I think it's true, like you said, of those different things, like mimes, jugglers, magicians. And I think, you know, even comedians, I think in certain aspects, when you look at it like on a family level, when you talk to people you love, you know, about like, I'm going to do this for a living.
Yeah,
like, that same dialogue happens where you have to convince them.
Yeah,
how, why, and how will you make a living, and why do you want to do that, and are you insane, and yeah, you know, did I not love you enough?
Well, so, I ask you those questions too. The financial piece I think is significant because we're in this weird place now, roughly since like 2008, where everyone used to think this is the kind of job that's stable and this isn't, and now nothing's stable. So that actually kind of helps us who are like, hey, we've been scrapping our whole lives. So I think there's some weird leveling now where people can see the value of having like multiple table legs instead of just being reliant on, no, I am a expert at this one, you know. So
right.
I think there's been a shift. But I'm curious, as you've pursued this work and you've been doing it a long time, right? Like, how long would you say you've been a professional?
Professional.
I saw your video when you were a tiny boy.
Maybe a few hours. I had a really good show this weekend. I felt finally like I could call myself a pro. I started when I was 8, and you know, and pretty quickly, you know, started doing birthday parties. Like, I did my brother's, and then he had 4 friends that were there that were like, I want him to do my birthday
party. Were you younger or older?
I was older. Yeah. I was probably 9 or 10 when I did the first birthday party.
You know, and they're like 7-year-olds?
And they were probably like 5 to 7.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Anything younger than 5 is really, really hard to perform for because, again, they haven't seen enough about how the world works correctly to understand
everything's
what's
magic.
Happening.
Yeah.
Everything is
true. And they don't really
true.
Care.
You're exactly right. Don't care. You know, most audiences don't care either. But they don't. And, you know, and that's why for adults it can be a really thrilling experience to see a good magic trick because you do know how the world works and that shouldn't happen, what you're seeing.
Yeah.
And that's truly amazing, and that's what all art's trying to do, is amaze their audience. But yeah, I was just a little bit older, and I don't have footage of those shows, I don't think. Somebody in my family must, but they had to have been horrible. But they still wanted me to come to their birthday parties. And then I had other jobs, like a bowling alley attendant for a few years and bussing tables through high school. Because my dad was like, you're getting a job. That's just what we do. Get jobs and you got to pay for all your expenses during, you know, high school and stuff like that, within reason. And
what were you working on?
Yeah, I was doing, like, yeah, I picked a bussing job. Yeah, sorry. I picked a bussing job that the owner said, you know, the last hour of the night I could go around and perform for whoever
was
left in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And they were all just mostly drunks or people that were, like, you know, it was, like, solo.
Yeah.
It was kind of a world of, now that I look back on it, like, this sort of sad, like, Italian restaurant late at night. But at the time, I was like, yes, I get to go around and perform.
Well, and you're thickening your skin as a performer, too.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You got to win them over.
And it was terrifying, yeah, to go up to tables of people that, like, had no idea that they were going to have a kid magician walk up. And people were incredibly kind to me, and I did thicken my skin. I had, you know, sort of the drunker guy at the bar, you know, go, you want to make me see a bird? You want to watch me make a bird appear? That's my magic trick. And then, of course, he flicked off a 12-year-old.
Yeah. It is magical. He brought you to another place where no 12-year-old should be.
And that's when I knew I was going to do this the rest of my life.
You've inspired me, sir. I don't want to be you at a bar, so I'm going to pursue this.
Exactly right. And so I did that, and in high school, we produced some shows. They said, you know, you can have the theater for a weekend to do shows. And then I got, I was like, okay. And I went, like, ham on it. I don't think they knew that I was going to go be, like, this aggressive. And I got, like, 20 friends, you know, from lighting designers to dancers to comedians, actors, and asked some illusion builders that were in the area to loan me some illusions. And we did a full, you know, 2-night production with a charity to raise money to help put butts in the seats, you know, give them a double reason to come to a magician. And we packed the place and ended up going, they were like, oh my God, you got to do this next year. And then, and that's when somebody kind of told me, like, you know, you could do this for a living. And I still really don't believe it. I didn't believe it then. I still don't. But I ended up going to school for business and theater. Mm-hmm. I pursued a double major in college. And when I graduated, all the pieces just kind of started falling into place. So that was in 2011. And so now I've been doing it. We're coming into my fifth year, we're in my fifth year, but...
Of that being like your full-time
profession. A full-time, yeah. And when I came out of school, I tried to pursue consulting because I had the business acumen to start through my own experiences of like four-walling gigs and doing it, but also just with the management and accounting classes and entrepreneurship classes. I was like, you know, I'm going to hedge my bets and I'm going to just go get a consulting job and then do magic on the side. And one of my mentors who lives in the Twin City area, Bill Pelfrey, said... I don't know if I should give full names. I said to Bill, he's like an entrepreneur and investor, really brilliant guy. And he looked at me and he articulated what a lot of people I think had tried to tell me in different ways. But he basically said, you have nothing to lose right now. Like you have all the momentum going your way. You just graduated. He goes, I know that you're smartly wanting to hedge your risk. He said, but it's not the right play if you're asking me. He goes, you know, if you divide your eggs into two baskets, yes, you're safer financially, like what we're talking about, but he says that your reward is limited. You know, he goes, if you put all your eggs into one basket, while the risk is terrifying, he goes, the reward could be incalculable, you know? And that hit home to me, and I was like, okay, no consulting job, not going to do it. And I burned through savings for the first 8 months. I did one gig in 8 months that I booked. They actually booked me back 4 years later. I just did it again. The Minnesota Women of Today. It was this women's professional community group, and it was up at Cragen's. And at the time, I was just desperate for anything. And then like years later, they booked me back, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
And I did that one gig, and I finally signed with an agent later that fall. And then, you know, slowly the next year, I think, did like 50, 60 gigs. And then it's now I do over 150 a year.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I hope to do more. I want to do over 200. I'd like to be hitting 200 to 250. I think that would be a great experience.
Was there? So you mentioned your dad saying we work. You know, you gotta have this job. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something really sort of important about that. I mean, that's the work ethic thing, because it doesn't sound like he was like, you have to have this kind of job, but you have to have a job.
Right. Yeah. Actually, he said, I'm going to drive you over to the grocery store, this little grocery store, Joe O'Malley's. I don't even know if it's still open anymore. And he's like, and you can get a job there. You know, we'll go, whether it's bagging groceries or working in the behind the register or something. He's like, in 2 weeks on Friday, he's like, something to that effect. He was like, we're going to get in the car and go over there. But in the meantime, if you want to get a different job.
Oh, nice. He's like, look, here's your deadline.
Yeah. He's like, I don't care what it is. Just go get a job. And otherwise, we're going to go over there and do that. And I was, like, really into anything else. It was a good lesson to me because I was just like, well, all right, so how can I game the system? Immediately, I was like, all right, how can I do this? And I realized, like, I need to get a job in something that I love. Mm. And at the time, I was really into bowling. And I found out that if I got a job there, that my bowling would be practically free. It goes from, like, $4.25 a game was what it was at the time to, like, I think 25 cents a game. Mm. And I was like, great. Cool. So I did that, and I did that for 2 years, and meanwhile, you know, bowled my little heart out. Man, I was such a nerdy kid.
How was your bowling game? That is pretty nerdy.
Pretty good. I actually just bowled for the first time in 2 years on Easter with my partner Olivia's family, and it was my first time in like 2.5 years, and I rolled a 178, which is not that good. At the time, I was bowling like 250s on average, you know, 220 to 250, and did the bowling team in high school. I started the bowling team. I clearly had no desire for women to be around me at all. Yeah,
you were frank about it.
I was putting up flags left and right.
did you or do you have any tricks that involve bowling balls or pins?
I do, actually. Yeah. One of the first tricks, that trick we were talking about, where I have to win the room over right up front, is one of the first tricks I do. It's created by a really brilliant magician, Kevin James, and it's a trick where you produce a bowling ball from thin air, pretty much, and then, you know, big thud on the floor, and you can go and pass it out, and it's a real bowling ball, and it's a really quick really cool trick that I wish I had thought of. It's one of those ones where you're just like,
so obvious
brilliant.
After too. Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah.
So I have one with that in there. But I haven't really tied it into my interesting history of actually doing a lane attendant job. I don't know if they want to hear that sob story.
Yeah, well, you'd either have to lean into the sobness or make it funnier
mostly.
Somehow.
It's got to go one way or the other. And what was your earliest job in entertainment? I'm hijacking this podcast.
That doesn't happen that much. I mean, my mom did in-home daycare, uh-huh. So there was always tiny kids at my house, and I was just doing bits for them always. I mean, okay. If I'm honest, that really feels like... I didn't perform until
that was like
I was
your
an
first
adult.
Pratfall, and you didn't even know what it was?
No, I was the funny kid in school, but I didn't know performing was a job thing. I saw a live... I mean, I loved comedy, but I saw a live... sketch improv show when I was 18, and I was like, this is in my town, I didn't know this, and I started taking classes, but I didn't do any of that stuff.
Type of form was the improv? Was it short form improv?
No, it was at the Brave New Workshop, so it was a sketch show and
it was
then long
Brave
form
New?
Afterwards.
Yeah. The first time I saw long form, it was I don't remember which one it was. It was a Herald version, mm-hmm. though. Some custom variation of a Herald. And I happened to be... I don't know if I happened to be there on one of those nights, you know, where everything clicks, mm-hmm. which is the greatest thing ever to watch. I think
magic.
The coolest... It's pure magic. Watching a flawless, seemingly flawless, long-form Herald is maybe as good as any, you know, high you could probably get.
Improvised comedy is... I think the best thing you can see on a stage, but the percentages are really rough. So like most improv's pretty lousy
because
it's so high risk.
Yeah, and I don't know if the first time I saw it, like I was saying, when you go in, I don't know if I look back and that was a particularly brilliant night, mm-hmm. or if I just was so marveled by
the magic.
Whole,
the magic. Wow, I keep using magic, like you know the way everyone says it. Well, I mean, I think that experience, and it's what I thought of when you were talking about. You know, adults and their relationship to magic. For me, I had this realization. I used to think I hated slam poetry and spoken word. And then I went to the national championship. That was in St. Paul one year, a long time ago. And the St. Paul slam team they won. They were amazing. And I watched the show and like I laughed and I cried. And then afterwards I was like, oh, I hate bad slam poetry. I didn't know that is a different thing. And I think that's true with
which
all
the percentages
of the
are a lot like improv too.
Yeah. But that's the thing with I think people seeing like I'm not into magic. You're like, no, you don't like bad magic. You would love really good magic.
And I think it's a good time for that. Magic's in a really good spot right now. There was a little period kind of when I was in high school, college, where it was kind of slumping. Mm-hmm. And it was like, who's going to replace Copperfield? How's this going to happen? Of course, he's still doing shows like 8 nights a week. He owns an island. He's doing fine. He's not leaving anytime soon.
In fact, he's sort of transcended, and he's not even magic anymore. He's Copperfield.
He's Copperfield. Yeah, he's Madonna. He's, you know, Lady Gaga. He's got that name where it's Copperfield. You know who he is. In fact, his name is like one of the most well-known names in the entire world across any continent. It's just like David Copperfield. Oh, yeah. It's like Houdini. Like, you know, one of those things.
Yeah.
But now it's really been booming lately. There's a lot of really good magic that usually only magicians were seeing that has now found its way onto mainstream. If you look at the shows that have been on the last year, and I know, you know, a lot of the people that have been on those shows that were traditionally magicians, but through things like America's Got Talent or Penn & Teller's Fool Us, which is on CW,
show.
It's coming back for its second season. They're filming. I think they just wrapped filming on that. To Wizard Wars on Sci-Fi, which is sadly no longer on. There's these.
Well, I feel
it's
like even
an
like
outlet.
As a person, Neil Patrick Harris was this big advocate.
Yeah,
like,
through
hey,
How
cool
I Met
like
Your Mother.
Magic.
He was the president of the club I'm a member of in Hollywood, which is the Academy of Magical Arts. It's the Magic Castle, which is a private black tie club for magicians.
You have to be like invited to go there. Right?
Yeah, you can't get in unless you know a member. You know who's a magician, and in order to be a magician member, you have to you know have a sponsor who's a magician. You have to go in many cases go and audition and show your understanding of magic history and perform for them. And Neil Patrick Harris was the president of the Magic Castle for I don't know how many years, maybe like four, you know, in between there. And he was a really great advocate. He was really good for magic. So I think that was a great point that you just highlighted, which he helped, you know, really usher in A lot of the really great magicians that are now getting limelight, that you're seeing really good magic. It's yeah. like, oh, no, watch that 5-minute clip on YouTube. That's really good. You know?
Well, yeah, so I'm curious about that for you, because there's this huge digital shift on entertainment that you can get whatever you want anytime you want it. And there's a lot of ways where that's really sort of threatening to live performers. I know I've struggled to find ways to make live theater that really requires that relationship with the audience, you know, like an hour-long show for an all-ages audience. Being in the room is really hard to replicate in any other ways. But I think there are, you know, you can make a short little piece and make that a recurring YouTube thing. I think a lot of magicians are finding ways to build audience online by not just doing the here's my trick, but having your personality come across as well.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how you think about what you're doing and the relationship to the way people consume things now and the way you can build an audience. Like, have you noticed a change from when you first were interested in magic?
Totally. It was a lot of performers, and not just magicians, as you know, comedians. Like, think about somebody like Rob Delaney.
Yeah.
You know, have really...
Twitter success. Yeah.
Yeah, and now he's just a celebrity. Now he's a well-known comedian that has a TV show, and, you know, but he really harnessed... It's all about being an... All the secret to business success is... one of my other mentors, Andy McKelvey, told me, which I still firmly believe, is he was the founder of Monster.com, and he was just like, being in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. He's like, you can do and prepare all you want and do all those things, but you have to have that element to you know, ultimately to be really successful. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I don't know if it's empirically
you can't not prepare, though, too, right? So, like, if you're in the right place at the right time and you haven't done the work...
Yeah, you have to be ready for it.
Yeah.
That was me with America's Got Talent when I first auditioned 5 years ago. Wasn't ready for it. I did not got talent.
That name is so dramatically...
America's Got Talent. And how bold of them to name that show that way, too. Now that I'm thinking about it, back when they came up with the idea, it's like... No, USA.
Right.
USA.
It does feel a little bit defensive. Well,
yeah,
America's Got Talent.
And then all of a sudden, that's the spinoff shows. Yeah. Then they syndicated it, and now you have, like, all these shows.
Dubai's Got Talent,
or, like, you know, Croatia's Got Talent. Like, I saw one the other day that I was like, how did that country so small? How did they get an entire, how many people?
They still got talent.
They still do. Maybe that's where all of the jugglers and great
they're all in Croatia.
They're all there. I don't know about, I was only making that
you know
up.
About
I'm
the
sure,
Croatian
now,
juggling
now
scene?
I'm going to get a lot of haters online. They're going to be like, yeah.
If Croatia, you're listening in Croatia, please tweet at Jared.
I love you. I have a strong fan base
in Croatia.
Yeah, they're the very best. I know lots of great people.
Wait a minute.
I'm not going to do that. No.
Is this part of your act now, too?
I think we should leave Trump impressions
probably
out.
Probably for the best.
They're all the best. I'm the very best magician in Croatia. They all know me. They all love me. Trust me.
That was a terrible impression.
Yeah, you have to be ready, in fact. But to what you were talking about with the online thing, that being in the right place at the right time, you know, like Rob Delaney or other magicians, it's like, you know, if that social media scene is hot and you come out with the right material, you know, you can build a really big audience. And there's a lot of magicians that have really been using that. It's a great way. Like, I'm sure on Facebook recently you've seen one where it was like a magician holding a paper saying, like, you know, I'm going to read your mind, and now I want you to think of this number, 22, and how many, you know, oh, now it's a gray
elephant.
Which
was done on TV by, like, Penn & Teller, like, 15 years ago.
Yeah. And now magicians are kind of cobbling their own versions to build viewers. Mm-hmm. The difference, like you said, is whether they're handling it to produce good content and their personality to sell themselves, or whether they're just putting out tricks that don't mean anything to build viewers, which so many people try and do when they're trying to make funny tweets, the pressure of the social media world.
Yeah.
It's like, and I think that audiences are really quickly, even online audiences, seeing through that BS really fast. You know, it's like, oh, this person's got like 10 million views, but like every video's the same. They're just churning out. They just want viewers. They're hungry for that attention.
Mm-hmm.
Versus somebody that might be really putting out some amazing content and you want to get to know them better as a person. I think those are the people that are ultimately succeeding and then getting TV offers and going on tour and, you know, building a more sustainable fan base. You know?
Well, what's your relationship to that side of the entertainment? Because, as you said, I think distinctively with magic, there are a ton of financially successful, comfortable performers.
Lonely who are doing young boys.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah. We're doing like 200, 300 shows a year, traveling all over the world. I mean, just close-up magicians and like guys who do amazing card stuff who will work a party. You know, like not even doing a show, just working a party. Like that's a
and
whole
make,
weird
and make
sub-industry.
A, make a shocking amount of money that... I, like, if I even uttered it, you know, on this podcast, people listening would just be like,
it's not
what?
Believable. Yeah.
Like, yeah, I know.
It's like six-figure income stuff.
Way north. Yeah, even north there. I know, like, for instance, you mentioned Neil Patrick Harris. He produced a show called Nothing to Hide in L.A. That's actually what's up on the wall in my office there. One of the most incredible shows.
Oh, yeah, Delgado's. That guy is amazing.
You know him. Oh, man. See, you know, you're
I've watched clips of him on like foreign TV shows where he's doing some really beautiful card stuff.
Yeah, I don't know how to say his name properly. I think it's Delgadio, and then Guimaré, I think is correct. But these two magicians, Derek and Helder,
are they both card?
Guys? Yeah, they're both card sharps. They're really, really great, and they have a very different background. Being that Helder is from South America. I apologize, I don't know exactly where, but the two of them, you know, Neil Patrick Harris decided to come on as a producer of their show, and they did it at the Geffen, and I flew out to go see it because every magician was talking about it. And it's just two guys with a couple decks of cards. They had some other props, but really you could boil it down to, like, the opening of the thing starts, there's 300 people in this raked seating section, and these two guys come out and sit at a little chess table with two decks of cards and a chess timer, and they... began
dueling,
and it was the one of the most astonishing magic shows I've ever seen. It was so smart, and then it ultimately went to Broadway, and they just closed on Broadway last year, but they did a run, and that was a very rare thing for two card magicians just to go and do a whole show with a deck of cards. And there, I don't know specifically about them in the private market, but there are people that are completely unknown that may continue to be that way, that literally I've met them, they might show up to a party with a few Sharpies, a few rubber bands, a deck of cards, and some coins, and they make over half a 500,000 plus a year, you know, and that's what they do. And they're, and some of them are really, really good. I mean, you can't even imagine if you knew kind of the amount of practice and the things that they're developing.
Well, that's the thing I love that, you know, why, you know, even they've made it very simple to understand. But when you read some of the books that Penn and Teller put out explaining a trick, you have to be willing to do a bunch of weird setup to make people think something amazing has just happened. Yeah. And the amazing thing is really that you're willing to have some weird thing taped to your leg for like half a day.
It's actually
in the hopes that the situation will arise.
Like the Prestige movie where he the magician that they were featuring, they were suggesting that he was pretending to be disabled in order to cover how he does one trick, his signature trick in
the show. And he just lived in being
that, you know. And I think there was that was an underlying theme of the whole movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. The if you knew how much time I spend.
Do you think about it? Like, do you have numbers in your head of like, wow, this trick took me this long?
Yeah, I mean, on average, a trick doesn't, I mean, this, for instance, one of the most recent tricks I do, a classic trick with a newspaper, but we put a really, what I think was a really new type of spin on it with a very sentimental, sincere narrative about the world, about the human condition, and it's my favorite thing in the show, and I developed that with a friend, a good friend, Eric Peterson. This just amazing writer who's a few years older than me, and he was in Africa with his wife on a state trip that is living there. I think she was a diplomat. I don't know exactly what her title is. She's representing the United States in a part of Africa. And he wrote remotely with me, and we developed this, you know, with his brilliant way he thinks. And that trick, I'd say I'm just finally like kind of hit stride with it 6 months ago, and that, and we started developing it, we just hit like 2 years ago. So the average trick usually takes anywhere for me from 6 months to a year to really get in, to be at a point where it's going in a show. And then it can take over that time, you know, to get it to a point where I feel like I can go in and kill with it, you know, go in and put it in front of any audience, you know. And so, yeah, there, if you knew how much time magicians, like a professional magician, spends on the silliest little thing that you're not thinking about. Yeah, magic is ugly. I think what you're pointing out with the thing taped to the leg, Teller, Penn and Teller, says it best, where he goes, magic is ugly. Like, you, the secrets are ugly. Mm-hmm. You know, to catch a, he always says, to catch a bullet in their teeth like they do, it has like 50 to 80 different steps that happen that were carefully worked out that are just so, they're so careful, but they're also so mechanical. Yeah. And it's not at all what you're seeing. It's like the, you don't want to see how the sausage is being made.
Yeah, it's not sexy at all.
It's not sexy at all. It's very mechanical, very science-based. And then you're merging it with the art base, which mm-hmm. is the performance side. You know, the magician is just a actor playing the part of a magician. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, so I want to hear... I didn't realize how much of a nerd
would come out of
me. We just
ricocheted off. Yeah, I'm sorry. I might have led you away from where you were originally going.
No, this is great. I know you studied at Dell'Arte, which is a performing arts school.
They accepted me for a little three-month summer intensive.
Yeah, but I mean, so I looked at that when I was young and started doing improv and sketch and was really interested in clown and mime. And I was like, how much can I learn at the gym at 3 a.m. on my own versus if I go somewhere and look at it? And I know a bunch of people have done that work. So that's really intensive, really body-based work. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how that informs the work you do as a magician, and then how much you think about yourself as sort of an actor or a performer when you're... How much is it... Do you feel like you're trying to be the same person you are on stage and off, and how much mm-hmm. are you not trying to be that?
I feel like I'm pretty boring off stage.
So far, yes.
Yeah, so... Thank you for the immediate feedback.
Oof.
That's the great part
I'm
about magic.
I'm glad you said
no,
it.
No, I'm used to it. I'm used to it because that's all magic is it's immediate feedback. Like a goalie getting a goal scored on him in hockey and the whole arena goes boom.
Yeah, you know.
Same thing with a magic trick. If it fails, you have failed at your job. It's immediate.
And there's no doubting it
There's
failed.
No doubt.
It's if, like a joke
if
that
the
bombs.
Woman does not appear there or if the bowling ball, you know, doesn't come about, you have a lot of splaining to do, Lucy. You know, it's like that sort of thing. So, no, I like that. What was the question?
That kind of training live and how the physical connection you have with your work.
Yeah. Oh, you were asking if I feel like the same person on stage or if I try and be the
Who's
same person
the real
on and off.
Jared?
Well, we'd have to go back to my childhood in Croatia.
Wait a minute. It wasn't in my dossier.
We're bringing it back around.
Yeah.
Callbacks.
Which work best when pointed out.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. I'm very heavy-handed
you tell
with
people,
my comedy.
That was a callback, by the way.
Yeah, I go...
Remember earlier?
Wasn't it Daniel Tosh that like kind of started doing that where he would go like, next joke. Segue happening now. I think that my onstage persona is definitely me. That's the only way it works is because, again, the audience has to believe you, has to trust you. So there, I am performing, but it's an exaggerated version of myself. It's a side, you know, like we know with stand-up comedy, it's like it's very scripted. It's very thought out. You know, I'm articulating with each eyebrow raise, with every gesture, you know. So it's very much a performance of whoever this slightly different Jared mm-hmm. is on stage. So I do very much connect with it as an actor, as a performer. In terms of the physical training that I received there, it was so cool. It was, you know, more than anything, it was it puts like a fire deep in you, that type of work. Because what they do at Blue Lake Dell'Arte, which is one of the few places in the United States that you can get that European
it's
physical
true
training.
Clown training.
Right. It's what we were talking about earlier when we talk about clowns, you know, and the way mm-hmm. people perceive them and if they go and watch it ironically or if they go to the circus. It's like, these are clowns, but these are like the archetypal, say that right, like, you know, like the buffoon.
Yes.
Or, you know, like these classic European things where maybe you're like, people are listening going, and of course they're artists, they know, but it's like, it's a clown, but this clown doesn't make you laugh at all.
Right.
This clown is scary as hell. Yeah. Like it's a little baby angry clown. That's, you know, that's a weird thing to imagine, but it's a very serious study of the actor as a whole, like, and you're like from your soul all the way to like the tips of your fingers, like when you stand on stage. I think that at the end of it, like at this 3-week intensive that I was at, it's about like that command of the stage. I remember the actor, Ron Lynn Foreman, who's a very famous American clown, but he's one of the directors there. And he was talking to us, and it's very serious. I mean, it's like military of clown theater mm-hmm. training out there in his class. I mean, I saw him like in a yelling match. I've heard stories of students that actually punched him in the face and he fell down cold, and he stood up and he was just like, yes, like that's exactly what I'm talking about, you know? And yeah. like, so it's wild. And he said, you know, I drop you into the center of the stage without light, without sound, you know, in front of, you know, an audience, you know, and you must, you know, I'm going to butcher it, but he said something to the effect of like, I drop you in that spot and without light, without sound, he's like, and you must survive, like, you know, you must own it, mm-hmm. you know, own every bit of it and stand there, you know, with your arms open and be everything, mm-hmm. you know. I totally butchered it, but the gist was like out there that the training was so inspiring and so motivating in terms of showering away like the bad habits physically that you have and like kind of stripping yourself back to like really trying to understand who you are on stage and what you're capable of, you know, and finding truth and authenticity in every little movement, you know, like even just how you move your hand in one motion mm-hmm. and these activities and these exercises they're having you do. I mean, like I was like sweating and bleeding. I even broke my foot when I was out there on the second to last day. I really did. Fractured my foot. And I was like, great. Theater. But it was like, I remember one exercise where I left the class that day. He had me do this same exercise. Like I was this tree, you know, expanding from, you know, the tiny seed all the way up to like this, mm-hmm. you know, thing. And it was this very choreographed motion that we were all to do. And he had me by myself in front of the 40 other students, these people aging, ranging from like 18 up to 65 years of age, you know, these theater directors and people from all over the world standing there watching me, and he'd have me do it and I'd get to the top and it was taking all my energy and my focus, and he'd go, no, you completely missed it again. And I'd do it again. I did it like 25 times. At the end of that on the break, I literally thought I might cry. I was like, I think what it did for me was it was this discipline of how serious you have to take every little moment on stage, like how serious you should take in your craft of constructing it and the amount of thought that should go into it, from the first word you speak to the first pen that you put to paper, you know, and to every trick. And I left there feeling very, you know, very excited about being an artist and a creator. And they put an emphasis on that and on helping you find out who you are. And I was very different than a lot of the students that were there. And so as I've applied it to my work, it's, when I came out, I was certainly doing a lot more slapstick and pratfalls and things and wanting to do that type of work. But of course, in corporate world and private events, there's not a lot of place for it in terms of what I'm doing. But it's certainly changed the way I think of how I tell a narrative, like the melodrama element and, mm-hmm. And just how I stand on stage, how I speak, how I breathe, you know, and that's, I think it's informed my work in a really positive way. And of course, with the magic of physical theater, you know, really thinking about the actor and how those characters could be involved in the various tricks I'm working on. I don't know. That was kind of a long way. You can edit. This is never going to air, right?
Oh, yeah.
You can edit. You can cut that whole section out and then just go back to, like, Croatia and we'll be fine.
No, what I really liked, we're running on time, and I want to get to, like, the last two things. But what I really like, something you're kind of articulating, I think it's really important. It's really important to me. The thing I love in any collaborator I work with is they take the work really seriously without taking themselves too seriously. I think that people often do the opposite of that thing, where they're really self-important and not, I don't, like, to me, I'm dead serious about comedy, which mm-hmm. it doesn't seem super fun.
But it's a serious business.
I'm a ridiculous person, and I think it's important to, like, make those distinctions. And right. I see that in you, like, you just were very sincere about the work, and then what happened, you were like, oh, I think I might be taking myself too seriously.
Right. Well, there is that element. There is that element of, like, for performers, like, we can all talk in a green room and talk about how hard it is or how much time you put into this one piece. It's been 5 years and I finally did it. Like the Birdman, you know, I think that movie, like The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, kind of sums that up, where he's in the bar with that lady. He's like, this costs me everything.
Yeah.
You know, and you can totally sit in a room and pat each other on the back and do that. And it's important because it is hard, but, you know, it's not hard. If you really, I'm not putting on boots and going out and shoveling. Anybody that's got a job at an hourly, you know, convenience store is working harder than I am. So there is that element of the perception where it's like, oh yeah, tell me all about how you work hard, magic boy. You know, like, it's,
you're not a coal miner.
I will always come back to that. So I think there's an element of that gets trained into every performer, where it's, you know what the world's perception of you is, and so you do have to have that balance. And it also makes you healthier, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you take your job very serious, the best performers and comedians are very serious. Like, Conan O'Brien's one of my favorites, and they say, you know, when he's crafting jokes, and Jay Leno too, you know, it's very serious, you know, and it's all about, like, oh no, we did that joke 15 years ago. Apparently Conan's really famous for, like, his writers will bring him something. He's like, that joke happened like 12 years ago on this whatever show. We did that. He remembers it. And he's like, that's not, start over. We're taking it back.
Yeah.
But you do have to, like, you have to enjoy it. But I think that balance of, like, taking your work seriously, but yourself not, also is, like, a condition of comedians and performers, right? Like, that you, there's that, like, self-doubt, that self-hate that happens that creates good content, that you, like, hate yourself deep down, but you're like, yes, I don't know.
People should listen to me. I'm worthless. I have nothing.
Exactly.
And, like, maybe the last 10 minutes, I'd like to hear a little bit about how the kind of work you do affects you having a personal life. So, like, you know, you live with someone and you're in a long-term relationship.
She doesn't know it, but yeah.
She doesn't know you live here?
No, I'm thinking about breaking the news to her soon.
Maybe you could share it.
Yeah, if you could email this to her, and then that way it'd make it easier to let her know I've been living in the second bedroom.
That might be the most passive-aggressive way of doing something.
I moved this office in today.
But you have a work thing that makes you travel, both short and long distances, so that can be a weird schedule. I'm assuming there's some assumptions here. You get obsessed with some idea.
No.
And I know at my house what that feels like for my wife, where she's like, what's happening? You're going crazy about this thing, and it's minuscule, not that important. You know, like, just finding the right word for a joke. Like, that is annoying to have to hear about at dinner for like 3 nights in a row.
Like, this isn't working. I don't know why. Wow, the audience laughed so hard last night. It got a standing ovation, and now it kills us every time. Why?
So how do you think about your work in relation to sort of your personal relationships? And do you do things to sort of stay aware and to not just be totally focused on yourself and stuck in your own world?
That's a really good question, man.
Or are you failing?
Am I failing? Yeah, no. It's easy to be complacent, is what I found. Like, you know, my initial goal when I signed with my agent and when I came out of school, when, you know, I decided to put all those crazy magic eggs in the crazy basket, you know, to go for it. I said, you know, I'm going to do this for 5 years. Not like I'm going to stop, like a hard cutoff, but I was just like, I'm going to put 5 really hard years of just performing as much as I can. You know, I had the opportunity to talk to some really high-profile magicians and performers when I was a student, because students can talk to anybody. Nobody's threatened. You're a student. Take
so
that note.
If
you're
true.
If you're a college student out there and you're listening, student is the best word that you will ever have in your vocabulary to get you into conversations with people that will not return your calls the second you graduate. It's totally true. As a student, I got to, like, meet headliners from Vegas, talk with them, interview them, go to dinner with the best illusion designer in the last 100 years, maybe ever. You know, and these people don't see you yet as competition, as a threat. They see you as somebody that they want to help, you know, and you should totally do that. But it's easy to get complacent. When I said I was going to do 5 years, it was like, I'm just going to focus on performing. I just want to get on stage as much as I can. And that's what people were telling me, like I said, when I got to talk with them. They were just like, you need to figure out who you are. And I have realized in the last few years, there have been moments, which is why I love all the people in my life that are not in show business, that are not in my job, like my partner Olivia, like, where, you know, she can tell me, like, you need to just let that go. Like, you're taking this too seriously. You need to check out of that, you know, or you're not, like, you don't seem like you're happy about this. You know, you can get in a rhythm, you know, and get complacent where it's like, all of a sudden it kind of becomes mundane and routine. And it's like, you need to change this up. Like, just the other day, I kind of realized a lot of my show props were getting tired from this schedule that I've been on. And I just was like, I need to, like, replace the cases that they're in. And it was just a little thing like that that sort of, then I went on the road for 4 dates this weekend, and it was just so nice to have all the stuff I was traveling with, not with, like, broken wheels or stuff like that, you know, and it just really re-energized me. And the people in my life, like Olivia and my family, are, their unconditional support is the only reason that I'm able to do it. It's the only reason that I ever got into it was because my family kept clapping even though the trick went horribly wrong. And they're also the people that can tell you if what you're doing... They're the only people, because show business and performing is so weird, you know? Like, an audience comes up to you after the show. Nobody, rarely, I have had people, when I go perform in the Midwest sometimes, like a farmer or an accountant from somewhere that they don't have entertainment, will come up and say, I didn't like that one thing. But on only rare occasions, you know, does somebody come up and tell you something bad to your face as mm-hmm. an entertainer. No, most audiences are always going to walk up and go, great show, you know? They're not going to say anything bad. So the only people that can tell you the real truth are either people that are on your team that you surround yourself with, like agents or directors or people that you have a collaboration with, or your family, you know? And for me, it's tough to walk that line to, like, you don't want to... I want to have a life outside of just performing. Like you said, it's a lot of days on the road, and I really look forward to, like, coming home. Like yesterday, there was a golf tournament on, and I just, like, I'd done a 1:30 a.m. show. I'd done two shows in two different states in 12 hours and then got 3 hours of sleep and got home. And I drove home early just to jump in gym shorts and a t-shirt and hang out with Olivia on the couch and watch a golf tournament. And so without those people, but then her also being cool with me being gone for 4 days and overnight driving and not being present mm-hmm. on, like, you know, important weekends and missing our anniversary dinner all the time. It's on the weekend that's, like, the most booked corporate weekend of the year, so we're going to change that with a wedding. But, you know, those, I don't know if I'm totally answering your question.
No,
but
you are, yeah.
Those people are the only reason that I do it. And ultimately, it's, like, not all about work, you know? My favorite play is Our Town by Thornton Wilder, and it's just because it's about, like, looking back. There's a lot of reasons, but there's this overarching kind of theme where you kind of get to the end of your life and you look back and, you know, it's about this girl that goes back and she's asking this sort of godlike character.
The narrator.
The narrator, yeah. The stage manager, you know, well, which day? And he said, like, the least important day will be important enough. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're looking back. And so at the end of it, like, I want to create art that's affecting. And that's, I want to create art that moves people, that fulfills me and the audiences that I share it with, and that is just fun, I get to do what I love. But at the end of it, I know it's like any other job. You're going to look back and it's like you said with your daughter, you know, going to New York. It's like those experiences, being with family, that's why you're doing it. Like, that's part of the entrepreneur side of owning your own business and being an artist and independent, is you have that freedom of control. And I love coming back and not doing the work. And I love that time almost as much, where it's with family. And I know ultimately down the road, you know, if I look back at the end of life, I'm going to care more about those time with those people that made it all possible than I will, I don't want to say that for certainty, but then just, like, you know, that night on stage in Fargo, North Dakota, you know. So your question, I think the reason I've kind of, like, collapsed into this weird rant is, like, because your question's really good. It's a really hard line to walk of, like, if you lose your edge in entertainment of, like, that hunger, you get to, that's trouble. Like, you have to feel deadly serious about
comedy. If you don't care, no one else will care.
Right, and you're not going to create anything that anybody's even going to want to care about. So you have to, like, have that fire in order to make it. You have to be deadly serious like you are about your comedy in order to have a chance. You have to be hungry for that next show, and you have to take every contract seriously and every moment on stage and every handshake with somebody after a show, you know, with life or death seriousness. But you also, like you said earlier, can't take yourself too seriously, and you need to step back and allow those people that are close to you, the family members, to be in on that and to tell you when something sucks or when something isn't working or when you don't look like you're content with what you're creating. And I've been very, very lucky to have people around me, friends and family, that have been very supportive, but also the first ones to say, like, that was weird, or are you okay, or did that work? And I think that it's absolutely necessary, you know, otherwise you become some crazy machine, sociopathic magician on the road to change the world, you know, like, it's I don't know.
I like, you know, the idea of 5 years away, and I see that you're, like, the cyborg magician, like, you've just taken the other direction.
Yeah, I have no friends.
I decided to be a machine.
Yeah, actually, the last day we ever saw him with another human talking was on Levi's podcast.
That was a really beautiful answer. I think I could talk to you about comedy and magic for several more hours, but mostly just for my own entertainment. I'll say, where can people go online both to see what you're working on, and then if they want to interact with you in any way.
That's nice of you to ask. My website is www.jared. Do we have to do that anymore?
No,
you don't have
to
say www.
HTTP. ///
And like Conan with a picture of Slash from Guns N' Roses. It's just jaredsherlock.com. Mm-hmm. Just my name, jaredsherlock.com. And that's jaredsherlock. And then on Twitter, I'd say Twitter, Instagram, which is just Jared Sherlock again. Nice. I'm active on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Grindr, anything that you're... No, let's not end on that.
How you regretted it immediately.
Immediately.
That's my favorite
thing
part
on?
Of that.
This thing's never going
on
anyway. Nobody. but no, I always love meeting new people and working with different artists. And yeah. I'm on those things.
Awesome. Well, thanks for talking to me, Jared.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was really fun. Can we keep talking after we turn it off?
Yes.
Okay, great. You're never leaving.
Never.
Thanks for listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Just a reminder, you can find me on Twitter @ThatLevi. Let me know who else you'd like to hear on this show, what you think about these episodes, how you're doing, any of that stuff. And don't forget, you can always rate and review the show on iTunes. It helps out the show a lot. Thanks a lot. We'll catch you on the next Pratt Falls podcast.